Okay, so we're coming today to the issue of immigration. And I have to say that over the last couple of years, as I've worked on this book and talked to people about topics related to this book, that this issue seems to be an issue that some people get really emotionally involved with and have really strong feelings. And it's easy for people to raise their voice in talking about this topic. And so it's an opportunity for us as Christians to try to talk about it in a reasonable way and realize that people can have different conclusions and different reasons, and we can try to listen and understand that. But here is what I think is the problem, and here's what I think would be an appropriate solution. First, I want to talk about some biblical verses. There's a set of verses about the sojourner, and then there's a set of verses under point V on your outline about what governments should do in general. First, the treatment of the sojourner. There are biblical requirements to care for those living away from their permanent home. Stephen, if this is too loud. Is it too loud, Daryl? No, we're good. I just don't want to raise my voice and deafen you by too much volume. Okay. We're good. Ron says it's good too. The sojourner. A sojourner is a person who is temporarily living away from his or her home, permanent home. And actually the Bible in 1 Peter calls us sojourners here on earth, away from our permanent home in heaven. And other translations do other words. Sometimes they call this person an alien or a foreigner. But the ESV uses sojourner. I think sojourner is a good word. Now listen to the biblical teaching about this, which I think has something of the heart of God, and we must keep in mind as we think about this immigration issue. You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt, Exodus 22:21. You shall not oppress a sojourner. You know the heart of the sojourner, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt, Exodus 23:9. When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Leviticus 19:33. And then verse 19 of the next verse on your outline. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 10:18. Now the question is, do immigrants today to the United States, are they sufficiently similar to sojourners in the Bible that we should take those verses and apply them? And that solves the problem for how we should treat the immigrants, that they are to be treated with love and care and fairness and things. When we ask that question, it comes to point U on your outline. Do immigrants today always equal the sojourner or alien or stranger of the Old Testament? And here I'm referring to a book by James Hoffmeyer called The Immigration Crisis. And I recommend this book, The Immigration Crisis. James Hoffmeyer is a friend of mine. He taught with me at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois, when I taught there. James Hoffmeyer grew up in Egypt. And he's an Egyptologist by expertise. But he's an Old Testament professor. And in his work as an Old Testament professor, he said, in the ancient world, the question of border protection was very important. The person who was a sojourner was always known to the host country and given permission to enter. He says there's a specific Hebrew word, G-E-R, ger, you would pronounce it, to refer to such a person. And these were always legal immigrants into a nation. That is, countries protected their border. When Joseph fled to the land of Egypt, or when Abram went to Egypt, it was known to the Egyptians that these people came, and of course they interacted with the Egyptians because countries protected their borders and they wanted to know who was coming into the country and who was not. Hoffmeyer says there is another group of people who come into the country secretly, but the Bible doesn't call them sojourners. Do you know what it calls them? It calls them spies. And of course, Moses sent spies to spy out the land of Canaan. And Joshua sent spies into Jericho. And of course, they stayed at the house of Rahab. And then they escaped before the Jericho authorities could arrest them. But those are the exceptions, and the reason they come in secretly is they know that countries are protecting their borders, and it's recognized who is in the country and who is not. That means that we can't automatically say, it says treat the sojourner, love the sojourner, care for the sojourner, etc., and say, well, that solves the problem, because there's a little bit different category here. There's a category of people who aren't like the sojourner in that they're not known to the legal system, and they're not allowed into the country by the legal system of the country. Now, does that mean the verses aren't relevant at all? No, I think the verses we should still understand as having, as giving us insight into the heart of God, that people who are away from their homeland and don't have the protection that would normally come from having family or extended family to care for them and protect them, that we should try to be sure that they are treated justly and fairly and mercy is shown to them. That is, that's part of God's heart of mercy. And so I think that though the verses do not directly apply one-to-one to the illegal alien today here in the country, yet they should tell us yet that there needs to be a heart of compassion and care for people generally that will affect how we treat this problem. That doesn't, however, solve the entire issue, because I think there's another point here, and that is, those sojourner verses certainly do tell us how we should treat people who are here legally and who come from other countries. And Margaret and I, where is Margaret? Way in the back. Margaret and I have been sojourners in other countries a number of times. And when we went to England, for instance, when I was going to do doctoral work in 1973, we found a local Baptist church there, Eden Baptist Church in Cambridge, England. And the people welcomed us and cared for us and helped us get settled and made us part of the church. And we still are friends with those people and count them, some of them, very good friends. Now, how many years later? 47? Is it 47 years later? So, and we've been to many other countries of the world where Christians have welcomed us as visitors and treated us kindly as temporary residents away from our homeland, that is, as sojourners. So that's a kind of an admonition to us as a church. If you see somebody who has come here legally from another country, then welcome him or her and treat the person well and extend kindness because that's God's heart. Now, there's another consideration. That is point V on the outline. I'm going to argue that immigration policies of a nation should be designed to bring benefit to that specific nation. And I'm going to argue that from Romans 13, 1 to 7, and 1 Peter 2, 13 to 14. I'll look just briefly at Romans 13, 1 to 7, the verses that we've come back to a number of times here about the purpose of civil government. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. That's Romans 13, 1. There's no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. And then, what is the civil authority's job? It says in verse 4, he is God's servant for your good. So, the responsibility of the government is to do good for the people of the nation. The responsibility of a government in general is to do good for a nation and to seek its well-being. And that means that comes from 1 Peter 2 about rewarding those who do good and punishing those who do wrong. That means, I'll read this sentence again, when we say, in the big picture sense, what should our immigration policy be? My answer is going to be, it should be what is best for our nation. And I think every other nation of the world should do the same. That is, the responsibility of the government is to do good for that nation. Now, if we're able to do that and do good for other nations of the world, as I argued earlier about foreign policy in general, then I think we should. And I think our nation has done good for other nations of the world in many, many ways for its entire existence. But the policy of a nation on immigration should be to say, what's good for this nation? And then the political process of the country should be designed to say, well, let's follow that principle. Let's do good for this nation. That's the responsibility of government, to do good for the citizens of the nation. If you will agree with me that in general the policies of a nation should do good for that nation, and in specific on immigration, the policies of a nation should do good for that nation, that's going to solve most of the questions that we have on this issue. The U.S. Constitution is in alignment with this general principle because it says in that very first paragraph where it states the purpose of setting up the Constitution and setting up the government, one of the purposes is to ensure domestic tranquility. That means peace and safety on the streets and in the neighborhoods, and provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare. General welfare means the well-being of the nation. So the government is set up to promote the general well-being of the nation. And the Constitution says that it's supposed to do that. And if it isn't doing that, it isn't doing its job. The implication of that is that the United States should control all immigration processes to give priority to those who would most benefit U.S. society, and exclude those who would negatively affect U.S. society. That's point 10. So I'm saying if you have a policy that's too good for the nation, if that's the purpose, then we should say if this 80 people in this section are lining up and I'm the immigration officer, I should say, are you going to do good for the country? Are you going to do good for the country? Are you going to do good? Yes, Mike, I think you probably would. And so I'm going to let in. And then all of a sudden I won't pick on any one person. I'll say this imaginary person in this empty chair. I forgot your name.
Greg.
It's not Greg. It's somebody sitting next to Greg. And I find out he has a criminal record, a repeated robber or murderer or something. I say, no, sorry, I don't want you in the country. Or he's an anarchist devoted to trying to overthrow the country. Sorry, you can't get in. A nation should allow in people who will do good for the country. I'm going to say later on, I think we should allow in a lot more people who do good for the country, in that our visa quotas are too small for highly trained, skilled workers who would bring help to the country. All right. So that's the background. But there's a compassion factor there still about showing kindness to others. Okay. Now, point B. The modern situation is different from all of previous U.S. history for two reasons. First, the number of illegal immigrants, estimates run as high as 13 million, or 4% of a nation of 307 million. And second, the permanent lack of assimilation for some whose primary loyalties are not to the United States but to some other nation. And the ability of many of these, many legal immigrants who don't have English language skills or job training skills, the inability of many to rise above the lowest level of annual income, and some of them then drain more resources than they provide for the nation. And you can get differing statistics on these, but they're a drain to the educational system, a drain to the healthcare system and the welfare system and other things. Okay. Some are very helpful. And there are some influential immigrant leaders who actually promote the lack of assimilation. I put two quotations here. One, Raul Izaguirre, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, former president of La Raza, a Hispanic immigration advocacy group, doesn't want to encourage people to learn English. He said, U.S. English is to Hispanics as the Ku Klux Klan is to blacks. In other words, don't learn it. I think that's a dreadful mistake. And another advocate for Mexican immigration into the United States, Juan Hernandez, says, I want the third generation, the seventh generation, I want them all to think Mexico first. Now, if we allow that kind of viewpoint to prosper in the United States, it seems to me it's completely contrary to the best interests of the nation as a whole. By contrast, historically, we are a nation of immigrants. Everybody who isn't descended 100% from Native Americans is descended from immigrants of some sort or another. We are a nation of immigrants, but these immigrants assimilated into American society. They learned English, and they wanted their children, and then they wanted, those children wanted their children to get job training and skills and succeed and do well and contribute to the society as well as earn an income for themselves. My father went to a school in North Dakota, in elementary school, for an entire year where only Norwegian was spoken. Esther, where are you? You would like that. And Sonia. My dad actually speaks English quite well because the rest of his schooling years in Minneapolis, he went to an English-speaking school. My mother, my mother's parents, my grandmother on my mother's side, had her Swedish hymnal until the day she died. But First Covenant Church in Minneapolis, where she went, doesn't any longer have a Swedish-speaking service. Are you Swedish, John? Yeah, John and Sandy. You went to Swedish Covenant Church, yeah. But eventually, Swedish immigrants assimilated. And my Irish Catholic grandfather, who lived in Minneapolis and who actually died before I was born, he didn't spend his life thinking, my first loyalty is to Ireland. He was seeking to become an American and to live as an American. So historically, the pattern is assimilation. But there are some communities, and it's not only Hispanic communities in the United States now, who are resisting assimilation and coming in and kind of isolating themselves in little enclaves where they're persisting in speaking a foreign language and have a foreign loyalty. And I had someone say to me in Minneapolis, there's a Somali community that is very isolated from the rest of the Minneapolis population. And in fact, last summer, there was, 11 or 19 Somalis arrested on charges of plotting terrorist attack against the United States. And that community doesn't show signs of assimilating. So that's a problem. Lack of assimilation, permanently and advocated by some. And I think that's harmful to a nation. And then, as I said, and then the first one was a very high number of illegal immigrants. So now, how do we solve that problem of high number of illegal immigrants and being invisible to the legal system and the problem of lack of assimilation? Well, I'm going to propose four steps. And again, you can add to this or disagree with me. If you would like, I see my outline says step one, step two, step three, step six. Step six, these are just, you know, first try at an outline. Step six should be changed to step four. Okay. Step one, close the borders. This step would stop 99% of illegal immigration. And it's in my own opinion, as I've talked to people, as I've observed what's going on in the country, before any other solutions to current immigration problems can be discussed calmly and rationally and with seeking a wise solution, before we can get to any other solution, I think it's crucial to come to agreement that we must take immediate action to effectively close the borders, especially the border with Mexico, from which most of the illegal immigrants originate across that very porous border still. And so my own viewpoint is it is inexcusable that Congress has delayed so long in simply authorizing and clearing the way to build a secure fence that would stop 99% of illegal immigration. Now someone says, and in fact, I saw a little video on the internet last week of somebody put an 18-foot high fence and two people scaled it in just a few seconds and climbed over it. But all it was poles sticking in the ground and they were blank at the top. There wasn't any razor wire or barrier or anything at the top. It wasn't like a secure fence would be. And it was easily scaled. But there are fences that work, and they're not rocket science to build them. A fence is not as complicated as some modern racing bicycles. I mean, this is not building a jet plane or a Boeing 747 or something like that. It's a fence, for heaven's sakes. And a double fence with a road in between and the electronic monitoring and a high fence, it could be done. And it could be done in a few months if Congress just had the will. And someone say, oh, you can't build anything quickly. You need environmental impact surveys. And Congress can pass a law saying none of that applies. Build the fence today. And it would be built in a few months. And to me, there's no excuse for not doing that. And someone will say, well, they'll always build tunnels under the fence or people will go over it. Well, it'll still prevent 99% of illegal immigration. And if you solve 99% of the problem, that's pretty good, I think. Maybe 99.9, and tunnels make noise, and they can be detected with listening devices and things. It would be effective. The United States as a nation must get control of its borders, as all strong nations throughout history have done. Try to get into China without permission today. Try to get into England without permission today. Try to get into almost any nation of the world without permission today. You can't do it. Nations protect their borders because they want to know who's there, because they want the legal system to work. And they want to have some visibility and accountability for people who are in the nation. In addition, as long as the borders are ineffective, we have no ability to keep criminals and terrorists and others who would harm our nation from entering. So it is an issue of national security. Even those who enter with no intent of breaking further laws but just finding employment do this in a way that's unfair to thousands of others who decide to abide by the law and wait many years to be admitted as legal immigrants. And then these illegal immigrants, become part of a growing underground economy and a permanent underclass that is not really protected by the law because the legal system doesn't have any true record that they exist. It means that they can be easily exploited. You know, an employer says, I'll pay you $100 to work for me today. And then at the end of the day, the employer says, well, here's $30. What's the illegal immigrant going to do? Go to the police? Why not? He's illegal and be afraid of being identified and caught. And so an illegal immigrant is easily exploited. And there's an injustice there. And I don't think that's right. And if they do harm against others, American citizens are not protected in the same way from the harm that illegal immigrants might do to others because the legal system has no way to effectively define them and track them if they commit wrong. In addition, illegal immigrants have very little incentive to try to integrate into society as other immigrants have done in the past. And they're more likely to form isolated communities and think of their first national loyalty to Mexico or Guatemala or Honduras or Somalia or other places. And they don't feel themselves in general. Now, there are exceptions, but in general, there's a tendency not to feel part of society. And if people don't feel part of society, then they don't feel sort of a moral sense or a civic duty to engage in military service or pay taxes or obey laws because their status is already illegal and their presence generates them disrespect from law. So in addition to that, it seems to me that these illegal immigrants are living in continuing, constant disobedience to the very first thing that Paul says in Romans 13 about civil government, and that is, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. If a person is here as an illegal... Now, I've heard people say, oh, wait a minute, crossing the border is just a misdemeanor. It's not even a felony. It's a minor crime as opposed to a major crime. Well, one answer to that is there are all sorts of misdemeanors, and there are very serious ones as well as minor ones. But the other answer is crossing the border was a crime, it was a misdemeanor, but the very presence here of someone who is here illegally means every single day they are living in disobedience to Romans 13:1 that says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. They can't be subject to the governing authorities. The governing authorities don't know that they're here. So, in this way, the presence of a growing illegal minority that is invisible to the entire legal record-keeping of society, I think, is a destructive force to the society itself, and it'll increasingly bring negative consequences to respect for law and the legal fabric of the nation. Therefore, it astounds me that anyone in either party, Democrat or Republican, would oppose having Congress take necessary steps to complete a secure and impenetrable border fence immediately. The problem has dragged on for years, with only partial individual sections being complete. A secure fence could be built within a matter of months and should be built at once. It seems to me that closing the border is simply a matter of establishing the rule of law more effectively in a nation. I can see no valid reason for opposing an immediate completion of a secure fence. I can see no valid argument to delay it, and I can see no excuse for making it a bargaining chip for negotiations about other aspects of the immigration question. So that's step one. Step two, enact comprehensive reform of the immigration system. Before 1965, the United States had a much more effective control over who would be allowed to enter the nation as an immigrant. Priority was given to those who would clearly bring benefit to American society. So if all of you, again in this section, were lining up before the immigration desk, I could say, okay, well, I'm going to let in you 40 because that's how many the Congress has allotted to me as a quota for immigrants today. And you 40 are going to, you fall into different categories. Maybe you're the spouse of an American citizen, all right, or maybe you're the child of an American citizen, or you have computer skills or research skills or job skills or other things that would make you a positive contribution to American society, so you're going to get in. And I could evaluate that, and there was a set number. However, in 1965, a law was passed that, for certain categories of people, opened the floodgates so that there was no set number of who would be allowed in. And that was the Hart-Celler Act of 1965. It was passed under pressure from President Lyndon Johnson, and it was passed by large margins in both houses of Congress. It was a new system in which citizens of the United States could sponsor not only their spouse and dependent children, but also a citizen could sponsor all of his or her brothers and sisters and parents living in other countries. And what can happen then is this. Let's say you have a husband and wife in Mexico, and they have 8 children. Here's the husband, here's the wife, child, 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 8 children. And then they come to the U.S. as tourists. They come legally, and they give birth to a 9th child, whom we will call Sally. Sally, the moment of birth, is automatically an American citizen. She can't sponsor anybody yet, but let's say that Sally grows up and she turns 21. Now, what happens? Under the Hart-Celler Act, she can sponsor her mother and father and all of her siblings. So all of a sudden, Sally can sponsor her mother, her father, all 8 siblings to come to the U.S., and they become citizens. And if her siblings have married, then they can sponsor their spouses and all unmarried children under 21. And I've given them a lot of children here. Just so here's Sally. She sponsors her mother and father and a child, her brother and wife, her brother and wife, her sister and husband, her sister and husband, all the children in the family, plus all their siblings, plus all their unmarried children under 21. And now one person has been able to bring into the U.S. 40 or 50 persons. And you multiply that out over the course of 45 years since the Hart-Celler Act has passed. And you see that we're no longer saying, well, if you have job skills or if you're going to bring good to the U.S., we're going to let you in. It's, are you related to somebody who's already here as a brother or sister or father or mother? And the number who are allowed in multiplies. Now someone says back to me, wait a minute, the number of siblings who can come in, there is a number, there is a quota, and there's a waiting list. Okay, so there's a waiting list of 5 or 7 or 8 years, but they still come. So that doesn't seem to me to be a wise situation. It seems to me that there should be a revision of or a reform of the immigration system so that who we let in should be determined on what is good for our nation. And the old system was you could bring in a spouse and dependent children under 21. That seems to be right. That seems to be fair. And I think we should go back to that. But what happened as a result of this chain immigration program is that the number of legal, and I'm not talking illegal immigrants, the number of legal immigrants soared. It was 2.1 million in the 1950s, and then 4.2 million in the 1970s, 6.2 million in the 80s, 9.7 million in the 1990s. Now, some maybe people think that's a good thing. We should be a welcoming nation. We should welcome all these people in. Fine, if we think that, okay, but it should be determined by a policy in Congress that says this is how many people we'll let in, and this is how many from each category and from each country, rather than people automatically bringing in ultimately 40 or 50 other relatives over which the United States has no control about who lets them in. Another problem with the immigration system is in 1986, under President Reagan, so I want to point out, I differed with President Lyndon Johnson's policy. He was a Democrat. I'm an equal opportunity difference person here, and I'm going to differ with President Reagan's policy, who was a Republican, and I did appreciate much of what he did, but I think this was a mistake. In 1986, there was an Immigration Reform and Control Act that granted one-time amnesty to about 3 million illegal immigrants who had come before 1982. People said, you know, we've got so many illegal immigrants here, 3 million. We have 13 million today, but this was 3 million. This is a big problem. You know what we'll do? Let's grant amnesty or citizenship to these 3 million all at once. They'll solve the problem, and we won't have this underclass of people who are invisible to the legal system anymore, and this will be a once-for-all solution. So that was passed. It did not solve the problem, though. It was supposed to be a one-time fix, hoping that it would never have to happen again, but it, in fact, set a precedent that people could come in illegally, and eventually they would get citizenship. So it kind of encouraged more people to come in illegally, thinking, well, if they did it once in 1986, maybe they'll do it again. And that gave added incentive to illegal immigration. And my problem with this is, overall, is the United States no longer has effective control over the number of immigrants that come into the country or the qualifications that it should expect from immigrants. So where are we on the outline? Comprehensive reform of the immigration system. I want to go back on the other side, however, and this is point B on the bottom of your page. Benefits of controlled immigration. Immigrants are, by and large, producers who can bring, who bring benefit to the economy and helpers who bring other benefits to the society as a whole. Controlled immigration can help limit immigrants to those type of entrance to those type of immigrants. Example of Nobel Prize winners in 2009, out of the whole world, 9 people won Nobel Prizes in chemistry, physics, and medicine. Out of the whole world, 9 people won those Nobel Prizes. 8 of the 9 were Americans. What should I say? Wow, that was nice. 4 of those 8 were foreign born. So just about half, 4 out of the 9 Nobel Prizes in chemistry, physics, and medicine were won by immigrants to the United States in 2009. Well, that's great. I'm glad for that. Although those were people who had come here legally. I think it is, and you could tell countless instances of people who have come legally and have contributed in a wonderful way to American society. So I want to say I am pro-immigration. I think immigration is great for the United States. We have 307 million people. I think we could take another 100 million people if we decided as a nation to do that. We could take another 200 or 300 million people. You say, where would you put them? My answer is, you live in Arizona, don't you? Have you ever driven just a few miles outside of Arizona? I mean, outside of Phoenix? There's massive millions of acres of desert. Oh, who wants to live in the desert, you say? Well, I have news for you at Scottsdale Bible Church. You are sitting in a desert right now. Go back, 50 years? This was just desert land. Who was here 50 years ago? Well, maybe I shouldn't ask. but I read there was a newspaper report from about maybe 20 or 25 years ago where a family was wandering in the desert and got lost. And died of dehydration and exposure at what is now the intersection of Hayden and Cactus. This was desert. This was wilderness. And you need water, you need some builders, and, and it can be a wonderful place to live. We've got a lot of room. And I think there are good and bad arguments on this immigration question, but as someone who has a little knowledge of economics, my viewpoint is that people who come here legally, are they mainly takers or givers to the good of society? I think we should think of people who come here to work as mainly producers. That is, they mainly, overall, in the net scheme of things, they mainly contribute well-being and good to the American economy and to the American society. So overall, people produce more than they consume, and we should welcome them if they come legally. I think that's good for the United States, and I think we should let the nation decide how many. But I would recommend that we admit many more than we now admit, because I think it's benefit. Okay, point C on your outline is next page. Needed patriotic and educational reform in the schools and the immigration process. I think that another reform should be that all children growing up in American schools, including immigrant children, should be taught the moral standards and ideals that have historically been true of the nation. Unfortunately, as I said earlier, because of some Supreme Court decisions, especially this Lemon v. Kurtzman decision in 1971 and subsequent decisions that ruled out the teaching that there is a God in public schools and that you're accountable to God and there are moral standards that he has, that ruled all that out. We don't do that now, but I wish it were happening, and I'm saying this is important. And any new citizens must renounce allegiance to any other nation and swear allegiance to the United States. No more, I have my primary allegiance to my home nation. Sorry, you have to have your primary allegiance to the United States if you want to become a citizen. And then the need for English. This is point C3 on your outline. The need to learn English for immigrants. English is the one language that allows communication in most nations. Learning English can only benefit immigrants, not harm them. Now, in the ancient world, Paul could spread the gospel to every country he went to. Why? Because everybody spoke Greek. It's because Alexander had conquered the civilized world earlier than Paul's time, and he made everybody learn Greek. Today, English is to the world what Greek was to the world in the first century. You go any place in the world, and English is the language being taught. Margaret and I go to China, and we find little children are learning to speak English. Barry Asmus and I go to speak in Albania, and there's a meeting of 300 people, and they give out headsets so people can listen to simultaneous translation into Albanian while we are speaking in English, and maybe one-fourth of the 300 people in this big meeting use the headsets. Everybody else can understand English. Three-fourths of them. They're understanding English. And I've mentioned we go to this European Leadership Forum in Hungary with people from 40 or 45 nations, and you go out to the lunch break in the lunch area, everybody's speaking English. Why? Because the Swedes are speaking to the Poles, are speaking to the Bulgarians, are speaking to the Russians, are speaking to the French, are speaking to the Italians. The only language they all can understand is English. So it seems to me cruel to say to children, don't learn English. It's crippling their chances for career advancement in business, in medicine, in science, in information technology, in just about any field of endeavor. And I think there should be a strong requirement for everyone to teach, to learn English. And point two under item three, the United States needs a population that speaks the same language for practical purposes as well to feel like one nation, one society. That is, if you have people who can't even understand the campaign speech of a candidate for Congress because they can't speak English, how effectively are they going to be able to evaluate who to vote for? They can't. And how are they going to be able to discuss their viewpoints on a political issue? They can't. Or what should be done in a neighborhood situation where people are deciding what is wise for just a neighborhood policy? Okay, Jack's keeping me on time. All right, let me quickly get through this. Expanding the number of skilled workers who admitted to the United States, that's point D. I've mentioned that. Large letter E, tighter regulations on employers regarding illegal immigrants. And then step four, which you have step six on your outline, point F, step six. It should be step four. What should be done about illegal immigrants that are already here? I don't think there can be any consensus on that until the border is secure and people feel that this problem is not out of control, but that the border is secure. I said that earlier and explained why. Once the border is secure, next step, deport all known criminals. That is, of the illegal immigrants that are here, known to our police forces are criminals who can't be found, but there are outstanding warrants for them, and it may run as high as I saw one statistic, as high as 400,000. They should immediately be taken out of the country. C, then require immediate temporary registration for some kinds of immigrants to receive, immediate temporary registration of some kind for the immigrants who remain here, the illegal immigrants, to receive any service from any facility in the United States. That is, close the border, then say, here's a plan for what we're going to do for those who are here illegally, and deport all known criminals, and then say, all right, if you are going to receive any service, that is, if you're going to receive medical care, welfare, allow your children to attend schools, working at any jobs, you need some kind of temporary registration. And that would say you're going to have a number of years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, I don't care, in which you are here, we know that you're here, you know that we know that you're here, and now you've got to decide, are you going to seek citizenship or not? If you don't, then you've got to leave. If you are going to seek citizenship, then we'll give you a path to find that out. So that at least we don't have an invisible underclass anymore. It's invisible to the legal system. And then, point D, establish a difficult but possible path to citizenship. I do not favor immediate amnesty as we did in the past. But it seems to me that the biblical requirements of mercy and compassion, as well as the benefit of the nation, require us to say we should want many, many, many of these illegal immigrants to stay and somehow become legal. Why do I say a difficult path? I think there should be a fine for breaking the law. I think there should be a payment of back taxes. I think there should be a requirement to learn English. There should be allegiance sworn to the United States above any other nation, requirement to learn values of American culture and society, and a record of employment. How long would be required before citizenship would be allowed? Well, that's a political question to be decided by our elected representatives. Maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years. There is a fairness issue about those who have been waiting in line to come legally, and should those who are here illegally be allowed to jump the line? But on the other hand, there is the argument some have been here 10 or 20 years working at productive jobs and contributing positively to American society. So I think a difficult but possible path to citizenship. Possible objection, foreign workers will take jobs. That's point F. I think that's a misunderstanding. I said it before. Working people are mostly producers, not takers, and the number of jobs in the United States can continually expand. F, what should American churches do about immigrants in their congregations? If they are here legally, we should welcome them and give support and encouragement, as the Sojourner texts say. If they're here illegally, I think we need to have kindness and compassion and love and honest counsel that we are to be subject to the governing authorities and they are to be subject to the governing authorities. Now, some people who say, well, we can disobey some laws of the land because the Bible gives examples of disobeying laws. My answer is, this is not a law. The law that you be known to and subject to the government is not an unjust law. It's not a law that makes you sin against God, and I don't think there's a right to disobey it. So I think we should counsel those who are here illegally and we have contact with that they need to make their status right in terms of legal knowledge of the country that they are here. And in some cases, that may mean helping, getting an immigration lawyer to help them stay legally, but honestly, many will have to leave and then later get in line to come back in order to obey the law. And then finally, what about a guest worker program where people could come in from Mexico to work in California in the agricultural fields for a time? You can disagree with me on this if you want. I don't think it would work, and I don't think it's necessary. The experience in Germany, France, Italy, elsewhere, Scandinavia, the Netherlands, is that guest workers just drop out of sight. They fall below the radar, and they just become a source of a larger population of illegal immigrants. And I think if there aren't enough workers to harvest agricultural crops in California, then the wages have to go up. If you raise the wages high enough, you'll get enough workers. You say, well, wait a minute, then it'll drive some farmers out of business. Well, maybe it does, and maybe some of the agriculture is produced in other countries. I don't think that's a long-term problem. We adjust to that as a nation. We have a few minutes left, 10 or 15 minutes left, to talk about this. You make it sound okay. What's your name here?
Joy.
Joy, we have a microphone up here, Ron, for Joy. Okay.
What is your opinion of the Dream Act?
Of what?
The Dream Act.
Tell me what the Dream Act is.
Where they would grant a road to citizenship for students who want to go to college or who would join the military.
Yeah.
That's briefly. But
okay, I'm going to come back to my outline, Joy. We have to close the border before anybody's going to agree on anything, or before we get a national consensus on anything. So I would say it's not the time yet. If the border is closed, then we can think about how to treat illegal immigrants who are here and want to go to college or, you know, who have been here 20 years and working or something like that. But let's not get the cart before the horse. That would be, but look, I can see a Christian saying, you know, my sense of compassion and justice for this person who's contributing to American society means let me give him or her citizenship. People could differ with me on that. I just don't hold that view. But I'm trying to model that we can smile and disagree with each other. Okay. Mike.
Yeah, Wayne, I probably want to, shall we say, emphasize some of the points you've made. And I thought was almost sufficiently emphasized your addressing a possible objection that was that foreign workers take jobs. And that I think one of our challenges in this country is in our immigration policy, and I think you alluded to it, it's been extremely restrictive under the premise that by, you know, restricting immigration, we are protecting jobs and protecting certain classes with in America. And I don't think we address that enough. And I think that you pointing that out, and if you actually look to the future where we're going to be competing with China and India in the future, one could genuinely say we just do not have the immigration and the population in this country to, you know, basically compete as a potential superpower over the next 50 years unless we are much more aggressive about our immigration and policy, you know. And that would be one of my concerns, and we just don't have that debate.
Okay, let me see if I can say back to you what I hear you saying. Yeah. We need many more productive workers.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying.
And that will help our nation.
And our policy, I'm saying our politics is thinking about restrictive, and it's been historically that way for 60 years. I mean,
And so I would agree with that because, here's the way to picture this. If you had the United States having nobody in the, just all desert and forest and prairie, not a person here, how much would the economy produce? Nothing. It'd be zero gross domestic product per year. If you have 1 million people, how much will it produce? A little more. If you have 5 million people, it produces more. If you've got 307 million people, which we've got now, it produces more than it does with 200 million people. And so if you have 400 million people, we'd still produce more. And there'd be more wealth for the whole society. And producers producing more wealth for economic value mean that the society as a whole is better off. And on that taking jobs question, Barry Asmus is great on this. He says 60% of Americans used to work in agriculture. Let me show a hands. How many of you now work in agriculture today? Well, it's 2% of the population. It looks like 0% of this class. I'm the first generation not connected to either farming or dairy production since as far as the Norwegian records can go back to in the Grudem family. In the 1500s, I didn't work in agriculture, and I don't know how to milk a cow. Well, my dad did. He grew up on a farm. He knew how to milk a cow. Well, so what happened? I found another job. And so did all the rest of you, and your children, and your relatives. So there isn't a fixed number of jobs in the country. That's what I'm going to say. Productive workers help the society overall. Now we got unemployment today, but that's going to be solved.
And just amplifying that too, the more you have legal immigration, the more you will suppress illegal immigration simply because, again, there's a job competition. Historically, you know, when we've had less skilled immigrants coming in legally, they will take a lot of the jobs and compete at certain levels. But again, our politics has been to suppress legal immigration of unskilled labor, which actually creates the market for illegal revenue.
Okay, that's a very helpful point, Mike. But I want to emphasize to all of us in thinking, productive workers help an economy. That's the theme. So, and then we decide how many is good. But this nation should decide not just a totally uncontrolled situation. Okay. What else? Roger. In the back, and then Julie. Oh, Roger. Go ahead, Roger.
It's interesting. I think the problem is in Washington, which is obviously broken on this issue. I'm speaking as a sojourner, by the way.
I hear it in your voice, Roger.
We left Hong Kong when it was announced that Hong Kong would be returned to China.
Yep.
At that time, it was a magnificent opportunity to increase the ability of immigrants from China to come here, but it wasn't done. It was done strictly numerically.
The United States could have opened the doors to many more Chinese immigrants coming.
Educated with lots of money. Canada and Australia chose who they wanted. They took the educated with money. We took them in order of application, which was a tragedy.
Stupid.
In many, many ways.
Wow.
Also, the borders between Hong Kong and China were thoroughly well protected by huge fences with roads between them.
The fences worked.
Those fences work brilliantly. Likewise, in East Germany, those fences that went up very, very quickly were perfect barriers to this thing. So Washington's not addressing it in an honest way. They're being very selective and politically correct.
Thank you, Roger the Sojourner. We are glad you are here, Roger and Shirley. So, good. Thank you.
On a practical Julie. Level on the American church issue, practically as members of the American church at large, do American churches and parachurch organizations, do we need to be about the business of evaluating who's legal and who's illegal before we minister to them, offer them food, and whatnot? I mean, how do we adopt some type of don't ask, don't tell policy within, you know, we have to be practical because churches exist very close to the various borders or within very close to enclaves,
yeah.
regardless of whether they're Muslim enclaves
yeah.
or Hispanic enclaves or
yeah.
Chinese enclaves, you know, those enclaves exist, and how do we as a church
yeah.
address our ministries to them?
Very perceptive question, Julie. I'm not sure. I still have echoes of Jamie's good sermon in my brain this morning about grace and the gospel. We proclaim the gospel of salvation by faith alone in Christ. That's a gospel of free grace. And we do that without saying, please adopt our behaviors for our requirements for behavior first. But the question comes up, what if someone trusts in Christ and then asks for counsel? Or someone starts coming regularly to the church and then asks for counsel. Then I think our counsel has to be subject to the governing authorities, Romans 13:1, and let us help you with that. I'm not sure what else. Margaret and I had a situation with a woman who was coming to do kind of a thorough house cleaning every other week or so, and we were paying her a certain amount, and then I asked Steve Ullman, who's my go-to legal help, sitting in the back row here, you know, what is my report? When do I have to start reporting this to the government? He said, after you pay her $600, you have to start paying Social Security for it. So when we reached the $600 point that year, I said to her, I have a hard question for you. And I typed it out in Microsoft Word and then had it because Word will translate it into Spanish for you. So I said it to her in English, but I pointed to her in Spanish and then kind of tried to pronounce it in Spanish because I've just had a few days of Spanish class one time. And she said, do you have a Social Security number? She said, no, I don't. And, so I was very sad. So then, I had thought that might be the case. And so we had this paragraph written out saying, we're just so thankful for her and we care for her and she's done such a wonderful job for us, but we can't employ her any longer here when it isn't legal to do so because we have to be subject to the laws of the country. And Margaret and I sat with her at the kitchen table and explained that to her and read through Microsoft Word's version of what I was saying in Spanish. And I had tears in my eyes. And we gave her what seemed to us to be a very generous severance payment in cash. And we've never seen her again to this day. But I thought that at that point, we had an obligation before the law to do this. Now, independent contractors that come to your door, and they have their own company or something, I don't feel an obligation to try to investigate the status of all of those. But she was in our home as a private person working. So I don't know if that helps.
We attended a luncheon meeting with a speaker on Wednesday. And one of the things he mentioned is there are no visas available for these workers who mow our lawns and
yeah.
do our gardening or car washes.
Yep.
And what he is recommending is a magnetic strip on temporary visas
mm-hmm.
so that we can keep track of them.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing he mentioned is that, as we know, the government is controlled by lobbyists, and there are very strong lobbyists, La Rosa being one of them,
mm-hmm.
Who are just giving money hand over fist
mm-hmm.
to keep the immigration, legal immigration things. We, you know, keep the fence from being built, to changing our visa situation so we allow more people.
Yep.
It's really sad because, but I speak for the common man because we have lawn people. And at one time I had a cleaning gal who was Spanish, and I have used that don't ask, don't tell to tell you the truth. But I think that we need a way for them to come in to our nation.
Yeah, thank you, Carol. I appreciate that. Now, one thing that Carol said prompted me to say one other thing. Why isn't Congress doing this? Okay, now there, I think I'm just speaking factually in terms of the political situation in the United States, but there is a difference between Democrats and Republicans on this, and I think among the Democratic Party leadership, there is a sense that allow more and more and more and more and more people into the country because eventually they'll vote more Democrat than Republican. And so it's a, so that the desire for gaining more advantage from one party over another has been the unspoken item in the room that is preventing, I think, a fence from being built and a solution to this problem. So that's my opinion. One more. Anybody urgently want to say something? Rose? Oh, and then what's your name here? David. All right. Can I do Dave and then Rose? And then we'll be done with Singh.
I have a small technology company. I employ 6 software engineers in the United States and 45 software engineers in India.
Wow.
If they could, all 45 of those software engineers in India would immigrate to the United States.
And would they
all speak English. They all have bachelor's or master's degrees.
Would they bring benefit to the United
Absolutely.
States? Absolutely. So tell me your name again.
David.
David. That's really important to keep in mind. We have unreasonably restrictive immigration quotas for skilled workers. And we're harming the nation because of this. Not good. Open the doors for those people. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. I mean, I think that certainly applies, and we can't accommodate many more people. Rose?
I just wanted to comment on your section C under B, which says some influential immigrant leaders actually promote the lack of assimilation.
Yes.
La Raza and some of these organizations believe that this land of California, Arizona, and New Mexico really belongs to Mexico.
Right.
And they want it back.
Yep.
And they want to flood the area. So that at one point they can do it legally. Do they not know that we paid for the land?
Well, and there was actually a war.
A war, right. And this part of the, yes, and part of the settlement was that
the United States military forces occupied Mexico City, and there was a treaty, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. If you want to read about that, I could recommend a book called A Patriot's History of the United States by a historian named Larry Schweikart, S-C-H-W-E-I-K-A-R-T, Patriot's History of the United States. It gives a good summary of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. But the residents of, not only was there a war and there was a settlement and it was done, and wars do determine national boundaries, but also the residents of those areas overwhelmingly wanted to be part of the United States. And so there was a regional sovereignty issue as well. And so Texas and New Mexico and Arizona were admitted in California. Complicating the whole issue was the slavery question and whether these would be slave states or free states. So there were some, you know, people say the divided vote in Congress on that treaty. But Schweikert explains that. And actually, I think forever Arizona is part of the United States. And it's foolishness to try to re-argue it. But you're right. Some argue that and think that gives them a legal right to be here. Well, it doesn't. This isn't Mexico. This is the United States. Thank you for your kindness and your good temper through all of this and for patiently listening.